His life was gentle, and the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, this was a man.
Pacifica Players presents This Was a Man. Today, the third program in a 5-part dramatic documentary of the life of William Shakespeare, based on a research text by John Monteverdi and presented by Pacifica Players. Yesterday's program dealt with the early stages of Shakespeare's career. Today, we explore his life in London, his involvement with theater, and the response to his work by his contemporaries.
The first quartos naming Shakespeare as author appeared in 1598. These were quarto editions of Love's Labour's Lost, Richard III, and Richard II. Since a good many quarto editions of his plays had appeared before 1598 without his name on the title pages, it can be argued that 1598 is the year when the name of Shakespeare began to achieve sales value.
The year 1598 also saw the publication of a work by Francis Mears titled Palatus Tamia, Wit's Treasury. Every student of Shakespeare must be eternally grateful to Francis Mears.
As the soul of you fathers was thought to live in Pythagoras, so the sweet, witty soul of Ovid lives in mellifluous and honey-tongued Shakespeare. Witness his Venus and Adonis, his Lucrece, his sugared sonnets among his private friends, etc.
When Mears turns to the genre of comedy and tragedy, he again singles out Shakespeare.
As Plautus and Seneca are accounted the best for comedy and tragedy among the Latins, so Shakespeare among the English is the most excellent in both kinds for the stage. For comedy, witness his Gentleman of Verona, his Errors, his Love's Labour Lost, his Love's Labour Won, his Midsummer Night's Dream, and his Merchant of Venice. For tragedy, his Richard II, Richard III, Henry IV, King John, Titus Andronicus, and his Romeo and Juliet. As Epaeus Stolo said, that the Muses would speak with Plautus' tongue if they would speak Latin, so I say that the Muses would speak with Shakespeare's fine filed phrase if they would speak English.
Mears' contribution is immense. He has told us that by 1598 Shakespeare had achieved a position of preeminence among English poets and dramatists. He has told us of the existence of some of the sonnets as early as 1598. He has verified that Shakespeare is the author of at least 12 and probably 13 of the plays. He has supplied terminal dates for the composition of the plays which he cites. It is clear that the hallmark of Mears' rhetoric is a slavish devotion to parallelism and balance. Thus it was necessary for him to list an equal number of comedies and tragedies. In order to achieve this balance, he probably exercised selectivity and omitted titles from one or the other of his two groupings. Undoubtedly, Mears is of great assistance to the scholar pursuing problems of chronology. He is of greater assistance to the non-scholarly lover of Shakespeare who is looking simply for comforting reassurance. Whenever a wild-eyed and zealous crusader begins to assault one's ears with assertions that men other than Shakespeare are responsible for Shakespeare's plays, one can murmur, Mears, and lay all doubts to rest. There is a poem written in 1610 by John Davies of Hereford, which is titled, To Our English Terence, Mr. Will Shakespeare. In the years following 1610, the written tributes to the genius of Shakespeare increased in number and enthusiasm. It is reassuring to note that those who offered the greatest praise were the greatest writers among his contemporaries. A peculiarly appropriate tribute occurs in a poem by Francis Beaumont to Mr. B.J., written about 1615.
Here I would let slip, if I had any in me, scholarship. And from all learnings keep these lines as clear as Shakespeare's best are, which our heirs shall hear, preachers apt to their auditors, to show how far sometimes a mortal man may go by the dim light of nature.
the greatest praise of all came from Ben Jonson. Jonson, an argumentative, belligerent man who was highly critical of the efforts of others, could not deny the exalted genius of his friend Shakespeare. His lines, "To the memory of my beloved, the author, Mr. William Shakespeare, and what he hath left us," part of the preliminary material of the first folio of 1623, can never be forgotten. "It would be impossible," writes Jonson, "to praise Shakespeare's writings too much. Shakespeare was
soul of the age,
the applause, delight, the wonder of our stage."
There is no point, continues Jonson, in comparing Shakespeare with other British poets past and present. He outshines them all. And even though he hadst small Latin and less Greek, his achievement ranks with that of the greatest ancient writer. Jonson foresees that Shakespeare must not be considered in terms of time and place because
he was not of an age, but for all time.
The genius of Shakespeare, says Jonson, was a happy combination of nature and art. The English theater droops because of his death. If only he could be called back.
Sweet swan of Avon, what a sight it were to see thee in our waters yet appear, and make those flights upon the banks of Thames that so did take Eliza and our James.
In Jonson's Timber, or Discoveries, a collection of notes written over a period of many years, there's a famous discussion of Shakespeare. Jonson recalls the statements of Heming and Condell.
"I remember the players have often mentioned it as an honor to Shakespeare, that in his writing, whatsoever he penned, he never blotted out line. My answer hath been, would he had blotted 1,000, which they thought a malevolent speech."
As Jonson proceeds to clarify his answer to the players, he attempts to point out that there were occasions when Shakespeare's effortless flow should have been stopped. Sometimes, says Jonson, Shakespeare was guilty of falling into absurdity. Unfortunately, when Jonson presents an example of this absurdity, he cites a passage from Caesar which is absurd only if misunderstood. And yet, even as Jonson finds fault with Shakespeare's work in this discussion, he is compelled to say that Shakespeare
had an excellent fantasy, brave notions and gentle expressions, wherein he flowed with facility.
And concludes his remark with the observation,
there was ever more in him to be praised than to be pardoned.
Perhaps the most perceptive comment upon Shakespeare by his contemporaries is part of the note to the readers by Shakespeare's acting fellows, John Heming and Henry Condell, in the first folio. They urge the reader to
read him, therefore, and again and again. And if then you do not like him, surely you are in some manifest danger not to understand him.
When one reviews that part of the life of William Shakespeare which was dedicated to the writing of plays and poems, he reviews more than 20 years of amazingly successful productivity. The works, written with flowing ease, were immediately popular, and Shakespeare was placed by his contemporaries at the head of English poets as early as 1598.
It is impossible to trace with precision Shakespeare's career as an actor. The first folio of the works of Ben Jonson, published in 1616, includes lists of the actors who performed in Jonson's plays. The list for Every Man in His Humor, a play first performed in 1598, is headed by the name of William Shakespeare. The first folio edition of Shakespeare's own plays places Shakespeare's name at the head of a list of the principal actors in all these plays. There is no direct evidence assigning him to a specific part in a specific play. As long ago as 1709, Rowe was frustrated by the paucity of information available concerning Shakespeare the actor.
His name is printed, as the custom was in those times, among those of the other players before some old plays, but without any particular account of what sort of parts he used to play. And though I have inquired, I could never meet with any further account of him this way, that at the top of his performance was the ghost in his own Hamlet.
It is pleasant to associate Shakespeare with the role of the ghost in Hamlet, and the notion of Shakespeare delivering the line, "Adieu, adieu, Hamlet, remember me," has vast sentimental appeal. One other role, much less appealing, was mentioned late in the 18th century, the role of Old Adam in As You Like It. When George Stevens produced his edition of the works of Shakespeare in 1778, he said that he made use of a manuscript written by one William Olds, an antiquarian, which contained notes concerning the life of Shakespeare. One of these notes had to do with one of Shakespeare's younger brothers, who supposedly lived to a good old age and was questioned by actors of the late 17th century about the acting of Brother William.
He, it seems, was so stricken in years, and possibly his memory was so weakened with infirmities, which might make him the easier pass for a man of weak intellects, that he could give them but little light into their inquiries. And all that could be recollected from him of his brother Will, in that station, was the faint, general, and almost lost ideas he had of having once seen him act a part in one of his own comedies, wherein, being to personate a decrepit old man, he wore a long beard, and appeared so weak and drooping, and unable to walk, that he was forced to be supported and carried by another person to a table, at which he was seated among some company who were eating, and one of them sung a song.
This unmistakable reference to the character of Adam in As You Like It is echoed by Edward Capel in his 1774 edition of Shakespeare's works.
There is conflicting testimony concerning Shakespeare's acting ability. If the apologetic remarks of Henry Chettle in 1592 indeed refer to Shakespeare, then Chettle found him to be
excellent in the quality he professes.
An excellent actor. John Aubrey in 1681 remarks that Shakespeare
did act exceedingly well.
Later comment is contradictory. Nicholas Rowe in 1709 was led to believe that Shakespeare was not an extraordinary actor. Edward Capel, in 1774, commenting on the possibility that Shakespeare took the role of Adam in As You Like It, echoes Rowe.
That he should have done so, that is, played Adam, is made not unlikely by another constant tradition, that he was no extraordinary actor, and therefore took no parts upon him but such as this.
It is possible that Shakespeare served his acting company in a third capacity, that of instructor. In An Historical Review of the Stage, written in 1708, John Downes asserts that Shakespeare instructed a Mr. Taylor of the Blackfriars Company in the role of Hamlet and instructed old Mr. Lowen in the role of Henry VIII. Since Taylor did not join the company until 1619, Downes is obviously inaccurate. And yet, in view of Hamlet's brilliant instruction to the players, one is tempted to believe that Shakespeare coached his fellow players to speak the speech.
There are documents available which establish Shakespeare's London residence at various times during the period of his direct connection with the London Theatre. In 1597, 98, 99, and 1600, reports of tax collectors complain that William Shakespeare of St. Helen's Parish has not paid his taxes. Records of the lawsuit Bellot versus Montjoy for May and June of 1612 reveal that Shakespeare was at one time a resident in the London home of Christopher Montjoy. The fact that Shakespeare is referred to in the suit as being of Stratford-upon-Avon would seem to imply that in 1612 he no longer had a London residence.
Little is positively known of Shakespeare's life in London apart from the theater, but there are suggestions that he managed an active and possibly strenuous social life. An entry in the diary of John Manningham, a barrister of the Middle Temple, for March 13th, 1602, is possibly revealing.
Upon a time when Burbage played Richard III, there was a citizen grew so far in liking with him that before she went from the play, she appointed him to come that night unto her by the name of Richard III. Shakespeare, overhearing their conclusion, went before, was entertained, and at his game ere Burbage came. Then, a message being brought that Richard III was at the door, Shakespeare caused return to be made that William the Conqueror was before Richard III. Shakespeare's name, William.
The incident recorded by Manningham is placed in some perspective by John Earle, who sketched a character of a player in his Microcosmography of 1628. According to Earle, a player of this period found that
the waiting women spectators are over ears in love with him, and ladies send for him to act in their chambers.
One of the occupational hazards confronting the actor in Shakespeare's day, just as in the present day, was the aggressive attention of feminine theatergoers. There's no reason to believe that the creator of Malvolio and Falstaff would have resisted consistently such temptation. It seems likely that most devoted readers of Shakespeare would choose to accept Manningham's anecdote. Shakespeare comes off quite well. He is ingenious, witty, lighthearted, totally free of inappropriate seriousness. Something about the anecdote recalls Festus' song at the conclusion of Twelfth Night.
A great while ago the world begun with hey, ho, the wind and the rain.
It is undoubtedly true that Shakespeare, along with other actors and writers, would adjourn from the playhouse to neighborhood taverns for relaxation, a quart pot of spirits, and witty conversation. Verses by Francis Beaumont in a letter to Ben Jonson name the Mermaid Tavern in Cheapside as a meeting place.
What things we have seen done at the Mermaid! Heard words that have been so nimble and so full of subtle flame, as if that everyone from whence they came had meant to put his whole wit in a jest, and had resolved to live a fool the rest of his dull life.
Thomas Fuller, the historian who began compiling his Worthies of England as early as 1643 and published in 1662, had heard of the wit combats between Jonson and Shakespeare which took place at the Mermaid and other taverns.
Many were the wit combats betwixt him and Ben Jonson, which two I beheld like a Spanish great galleon and an English man of war. Master Jonson, like the former, was built far higher in learning, solid but slow in his performances. Shakespeare, with the English man of war, lesser in bulk but lighter in sailing, could turn with all tides, tack about and take advantage of all winds by the quickness of his wit and invention.
There is no reason to believe, as some have suggested, that Shakespeare was a heavy drinker. The accounts of Beaumont and Fuller imply that the meetings at the Mermaid were primarily occasions for brilliant conversation. John Aubrey notes that Shakespeare, when invited to debauch, wrote that he was in pain. John Ward's diary for 1661 and 63 mentions the tragic result of one drinking bout.
Shakespeare, Drayton, and Ben Jonson had a merry meeting, and it seems drank too hard, for Shakespeare died of a fever there contracted.
There are strong indications, although no absolute proofs, that Shakespeare was involved in serious love affairs, quite distinct from occasional interludes with stray theatergoers while away from Stratford. A curious poem called Willoughby, His Avisa, was registered on September 3, 1594, and printed in the same year. The author is probably one Henry Willoughby, a former student at Oxford. The poem describes a succession of assaults upon the virtue of one Avisa by four men, including Willoughby. There is a verse dialogue between Willoughby and one designated as W.S. A prose discussion preceding this dialogue sheds some light on the identity of W.S.
H.W., being suddenly infected with the contagion of a fantastical fit at the first sight of A., pineth a while in secret grief. At length, not able any longer to endure the burning heat of so fervent a humour, betrayeth the secrecy of his disease unto his familiar friend W.S., who not long before had tried the courtesy of the like passion, and was now newly recovered of the like infection. Yet finding his friend let blood in the same vein, he took pleasure for a time to see him bleed, and instead of stopping the issue, he enlargeth the wound with the sharp razor of a willing conceit, persuading him that he thought it a matter very easy to be compassed, and no doubt with pain, a diligence, and some cost in time to be obtained. Thus this miserable comforter, comforting his friend with an impossibility, either for that he would now secretly laugh at his friend's folly, that had given occasion not long before unto others to laugh at his own, or because he would see whether another could play his part better than himself. And in viewing afar off the course of this loving comedy, he determined to see whether it would sort to a happier end for this new actor than it did for the old player.
The verse dialogue between H.W. Willoughby and W.S. contains two lines spoken by W.S. which vaguely echo lines in Titus Andronicus. The fact that W.S. is described with imagery drawn from the theater has, of course, led many to believe that W.S. is William Shakespeare. If the identification can be made, then Willoughby, his Avisa, tells us that Shakespeare had been involved in a pain-producing love affair with an unknown sometime in 1594.
You've been listening to This Was a Man. Today, the third program in a five-part documentary of William Shakespeare's life. The players were Richard Peele as Francis Mears, Gabriel Harvey, the publisher, and Nicholas Rowe. Donald Freed as Henry Condell, William O'Connell as John Weaver, the character Julio, John Earle and Henry Willoughby, Joseph Burns as Francis Beaumont and Ben Jonson, Norman Belkin as William Olds and Thomas Fuller, John Hulton as Henry Chettle and John Ward, Ben Wright as John Aubrey and Bruce Timpson as John Manningham. This Was a Man was based on a research text by John Monteverdi, adapted for radio by Lee Whiting, directed and produced by Ruth Hirschman and Lee Whiting, with technical assistance by Michael Dayton. This program, a production of the Drama and Literature Department of Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles.